I know you can hear me, and hopefully this isn't too weird, but I'm going to call in on my own phone. Let's see here.
Hello?
Hey, you there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
But there's a terrible echo?
I don't hear an echo.
Well, lucky you.
See, how's that?
Yeah, I can... No, you're fine.
Well, we might be on the air,
so I'm just going to go ahead and fire it up. Let's see.
I don't know
if I could function with this much of an echo. Lord.
Good times.
Don't even get me started. here we go with the theme music. No, the theme music seems to kind of get a little bit worse and more broken apart every time I use it. Welcome. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you.
I know it's odd because I really don't, now I've got to walk away from the control panel, so I don't really know whether this is going out to the masses or just playing into the ether. But welcome, you and America to Fabulous of Blog Talk Radio's Skid Row Chatter, hosted, or actually sponsored by the mighty Down and Out Books. Our guest today, Jordan Harper, a man who I know virtually nothing about, and I hope to uncover all his dirty secrets. How are you, Jordan? Welcome.
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm just fine.
Except for the every time I walk near my computer, I get a strange echo, so I'm going to go stand in a virtual closet. Well, I'm just going to wing the questions for tonight, which I promise you it would be quick and painless, and I only have a short few questions. But I just finished your new book, She Rides Shotgun, and I've been a fan of yours ever since the short stories, American Death Songs, but kind of the same as your second collection, right? Essentially, there was just a few more stories in the second collection.
Yeah, I mean, American Death Songs was just my self-published short story collection, and then when it got published with Echo, it lost one story and gained two. So it's basically the same collection, yeah.
Well, I've been going through the book, and I did, see there was at least one that I remember, a connection with the short stories in She Rides Shotgun, but I was thinking to myself, I don't really know a lot about you. Where the hell are you from?
I am from Springfield, Missouri, which is known as the Queen City of the Ozarks. It's it's the third largest city in the state of Missouri, and it's in the southwest corner, close to the Oklahoma-Arkansas borders. And it is the Ozarks. It is the birthplace of John Ashcroft, and it's a very, very red place that I guess has kind of expanded since I left. When I left, that was the conservative part of Missouri, really. And now, as far as I can tell, Missouri is all that now, except for just like the very small parts of Kansas City and St. Louis. But yeah, no, so I grew up in like the suburban version of Daniel Woodrell. Like I did not grow up in Daniel Woodrell country, but like it was filmed right outside of Springfield. Like, so I know that, but I'm not from that.
Well, here's why I ask, because you capture, it's not really, I guess it is rural California, like those tiny towns, you know, above the grapevine out there, like Lansdale, Fontana, places like that. You captured them so well. I thought, man, you had to have spent some of your youth out in California. When did you come out to California?
I got here about a decade ago. But to be honest, I mean, you know, I have been out to Fontana, especially when I was writing this book. Almost every place that's in the book is a physical place that I've been to, or at least a fictionalized version of a physical place I've been to. And the thing about like Fontana is, like I said, I'm from the Ozarks, and that's shit kicker country, and shit kickers are the same all over. You know, there's really, you know, it's at one point, it was a good thing to cut out of the book, but at one point I even kind of traced how, you know, that kind of certain type of Scotch-Irish redneck kind of came through America like a skipping stone and landed in Appalachia and then landed in the Ozarks and then, you know, bounced on down all the way down to Fontana. So I feel like I grew up with those people, and they're not that different in California than they are anywhere else.
Well, true, but there's a certain sort of flavor in California that is pretty consistent. I guess maybe in the Southwest, but you seem to have touched on it really so well that, man, I guess now that I think about it, I did know where you grew up, although I associate you with the Chicago for some reason as well. But I was just so impressed with, and also, you know, the whole California prison culture, which is, you know, a whole another netherworld. But
sure.
No one, you know, Pelican Bay from Susanville, and those, you know, the different degrees of danger in each place, and that was a great feat, I felt.
Oh, thank you. You know, I am as a lot of us in this world are, but I am a crime nerd, and the California prison system is a really fascinating place. I've always been obsessed with prison gangs. My grandfather was a prison guard. His father was a prison guard. So I've always been interested in prisons, but like the California one, I think I was a weird kid. I grew up, like I said, in Springfield, Missouri, and knew from a very early age that I didn't fit in. And so I was a weird kid with a mohawk and shit like that. And so I like read George Jackson books. Yeah. I didn't mean like I wasn't a 10-year-old with a mohawk, but you know, I read George Jackson's books when I was a little kid, and I got very into the idea of the radical prison system in California. And then I read Monster by Sandeep Shakur. Have you ever read that?
I actually have. Yes.
Yeah. I read that when I was, I don't know, whenever it came out, 14 or 15, I guess.
On Penguin, no less.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it was initially put out by, well, I assume it still is put out by Penguin. But yeah, about the big South Central kid who just crazy stories of riding around on his bicycle with shotguns when they were 13, 14 years old. Yeah, that's the one, right?
Yeah, that's exactly the one. And because I think I was about 13 or 14 when I read it. And there's one incident in particular where he goes to a grocery store with his mother and winds up like shooting at another kid in a grocery store with his mother. That to me always really made me, that rang true, because I'd been to the grocery store with my mother many times and I had never been in a shootout. But he goes to Pelican Bay. Yeah. He goes to Pelican Bay in that book. And I think that was my first introduction to that idea of like how they do the deep segregation there, where they roll up the showers. So you literally like don't see a human being. It's a fascinating thing.
My brother-in-law was in Susanville for a while before he managed to get transferred out to Ione, and then he ended up doing 18 years,
wow.
So I've always just noticed the high desert as being one of the most dangerous and frightening places in the California prison system, and that's setting the bar kind of high. And my wife, actually, who you met briefly in New Orleans, she worked in San Quentin for quite a while, and I was surprised to find out that San Quentin is actually kind of in the middle of the scale, because it's for one, they got so many social programs there, and number two, it's not really medium security, but it's not really where they send the gnarliest offenders.
Interesting. But it's just cruising on its rep, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's what it's doing. Yeah, an old rep. You know, I don't get all spoilery, because a lot of people are reading the book, and you know, I initially was hoping to interview you before it came out, which I could have done that. You know, what's it really about and that kind of thing, but I don't want to ruin stuff. But my take on it, speaking of George Jackson, was, you know, if I had to do the quickie description, I think I would say Judy Blume meets Ice Pick Slim. What do you think?
You know, my little pocket, that is very good. My little pocket description of it has always been Paper Moon with a body count.
There you go. Oh, that's better. Yeah, see, that's why you get the big bucks, Jordan.
Well, it's Hollywood, right? They teach us to do that here.
Go ahead before I drop the bomb. Go ahead.
Oh no, it's gone into the ether now. So let's talk Hollywood.
Well, here's the thing. I've interviewed before by accident on this very show while we were in New Orleans, and I do this a lot around people who, in the entertainment business. There is that elephant in the room, and I don't want to bring it up. And I don't know whether it was a fear that you know, you've just been asked too much about it, or whether, you know, it's just sort of like, you know, the embarrassing thing you don't want to, you know, and I thought about it, and I was like, you know, I don't know why I just didn't breach it before, but your day job is pretty crazy. It's not like my day job or a lot of writers' day jobs. You want to tell our eager audience about it?
Sure. I have for the last I haven't in the last year, but I've been working as a television writer out here in Hollywood since I think 2009, and I came out here around then. And you know, I've been writing short fiction. I'd written a lot of the stories that American Death Songs that turned into American Death Songs. And I'd written one novel that was, and I'm not being like modest here, I'd written a very bad novel. And so I wound up coming out here and having no idea how to break into television or film. Actually, you know, I came out here thinking I would write movies, because I didn't understand at the time how much the economy of Hollywood had changed, and that to be a writer nowadays, basically, there are far more TV writers than there are feature writers at this point. And there are something like 600 television shows in production right now in Hollywood. And each one of those probably has, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 writers for it. So you can see that's a pretty big pool. Anyway, I didn't know that at the time, so I came out here to be a feature writer. And then I found out about a thing called the Warner Brothers Writers Workshop, which is a thing where Warner Brothers will train you to be a TV writer. And to get in, what you do is you write what's called a spec script, which is you take an episode of an existing show and just you make up an episode of a show that's on the air already. And I took one of the short stories from Love and Other Wounds or American Death Songs, a story called Heart Check, and I turned it into an episode of The Shield, which was in its last season at the time. And turn that into Warner Brothers, and somehow I managed to get into the workshop, and they trained me in how to be a TV writer, and they wound up placing me with Bruno Heller, who at the time had created Rome and had just created this show called The Mentalist. And so I was on The Mentalist from seasons 2 through 7, and then went with Bruno over to Gotham, which he also created, and I was on that through part of the first season and the second season, and then I left. And since then, I've been freelancing and writing the screenplay for She Rides Shotgun. But yeah, so that's my day job.
Well, I'm glad you were. I don't know why I felt trepidatious about ever bringing that up. I just figured it was, you know, it was a little bit like, you know, bumping into a movie star and asking them for their autograph in the elevator. It's just, you know what, it's a little gauche. Just for, you know, act like you don't know.
I would say, you know, nowadays it's not autographs anymore, it's pictures. And when you work in Hollywood, you're supposed to have this thing where you're cool and you don't ask people to take pictures with you, right? Because you're in the industry,
Never.
So you want to be cool. So I've only broken that once so far on the job. And it was, I did one episode of The Mentalist with Malcolm McDowell. And on the last day of filming, I turned to the director and I was like, I'm getting a picture with Malcolm McDowell. And he's like, I am too. And so we did. And that was the one time. People always want to know. TV writing is one of those jobs that people just have questions about. So I never mind talking about it.
Well, it's something that certainly sparks, you know, even among the crime community, and I'm certainly guilty of it. You know, you start discussing books or ideas or concepts with someone, and almost immediately the comparison is to film, and it always jumps to film. And that's just something that I think, you know, we got to reconcile ourselves with it. It's a more popular medium, and you know, with good reason in a lot of ways, and it'll never overtake what books do in the culture, but it certainly is something that is more tangible to people. It's an easier touchstone, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, I think I always wanted to be a writer since I was a little kid, and so I can't say that I don't know, crime books didn't turn me into a crime writer. Crime movies did, absolutely. Like, I grew up reading like Stephen King and things like that, but I grew up watching The Godfather and Goodfellas. I really think that as far as when people ask me about influences for She Rides Shotgun, I would say that Quentin Tarantino, particularly like True Romance era Quentin Tarantino, is as big an influence on me as any author. I would love to tell you that, you know, it's so Jim Thompson, but it's not. It's more Tarantino than it is Jim Thompson.
I would agree. I would definitely agree. Well, let me ask you this, since we're on the subject of The Mentalist and Gotham, did being involved in shows like that and having that being your gig where you had to sort of adhere to a preordained sort of idea of what was happening, did that drive you towards, you know, wanting to show the world your own sort of dark vision of what you saw as reality, the movie you were seeing in your head?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the Mentalist did what it did as well as any show does that. And I'm proud of it. It also taught me a whole lot about writing. You know, the structure of those things are so tight that you walk away with just an intrinsic understanding of the mechanisms of story. That I joke that I got paid to go to grad school, but I would also say that writing on The Mentalist, which while a crime show is one of those, it's more like a cozy than hard boiled for sure. And wanting to escape that moral universe had a lot to do with me getting back into writing crime fiction, particularly writing She Rides Shotgun. Yeah,
because there is it's so much more gritty. You know, it's a there's a real sense of, to me at least, of reality. And like I mentioned with just knowing the California prison system and those small town California attitudes and personalities and people, it has it very much has both feet on the ground. You know, I will say this, you know, your agent is pretty famous, or I will ask this, your agent is pretty, famously involved in his clients' works, you know, the story that it's a famous story about Elroy. But was he involved? Did you have a lot of back and forth with him? Or the book that you submitted, was it pretty much done, or did you have to jump through hoops?
No, I jumped through a few hoops, you know, and Nat Sobel is, to my mind, you know, like one of the great, you know, literary lions of crime fiction, and he really deserves the reputation. And, he's told me great stories about helping Elroy. And, my first draft that I gave him was fairly different than the book that it is now. The character of Park didn't exist until he suggested that it needed a police figure in the book.
Which I dig. I like that. I will say in my own writing, when I'm writing a book, when I get to that, you know, that chapter sort of partway in where you've got to sort of switch gears and, you know, meanwhile back at the ranch and you go to the police, that's when it kind of warms up for me. That's when I really got to get the, now I'm in the story. And, you know, I guess when I read it too. Although Park came in, I guess it makes sense because he came in a little late. A little later than I would have thought. But, I dug him. I dug that whole angle with him.
Yeah, he came in – there was also a draft where he came in earlier and you saw him at the crime scene. And I realized that I didn't want to show the crime scene twice. And the way – I don't want to get too spoilery, but, like, the way it is now with the person who goes to the crime scene now is much more effective. But, to get back to your earlier question, though, Nat was invaluable and really had a lot of really great notes. He helped me dig out stuff about Polly. I mean, Polly's character was fairly fully formed, but and he didn't suggest this, but by him pressing on needing to introduce her a little stronger at the top is where I came up with the whole metaphor about her being from Venus, which is, I think, something that I'm very proud of in the book. That wasn't in the first draft that I gave him. And he gives as good notes as anybody I've ever met. And you listen to him when he talks. He edited Eddie Bunker. He edited, Joseph Wamba. As an agent, he edited them, but he gave notes to these guys and obviously to Elroy and was in the room. I don't know if this is the famous story you mean, but he was in the room when Elroy created Elroy's like clip style. Like he literally watched him do it.
Well, the story I got was they got it back from the publisher and they said, we're not publishing a 800-page book. So they together had to go through and there was too many characters to chop out characters and chop out threads of the plot. So they had to actually chop down sentences. And that's where that sort of rat-a-tat-tat style came from.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. I mean, Nat told me that story about being in the room and watching Elroy just start to cross out words and going, oh, wait, you know what? Like, I can do this. I can cut this down without, yes, like you said, without losing any plot, without losing any characters. I can do this. And it's really a great example of, like, yeah. But it's a great lesson of, like, everybody wants freedom. And sometimes, it's the biggest cliche in the world that, necessity is the mother of invention. But, like, that's an amazing thing to happen. And it really makes you think, like, there should be more restraints put on my story somehow. Like I should find somebody to give me a couple of rules to follow for my next book, just so you don't have that feeling of yawning possibility.
Well, I just know from my personal experience, trying to shave down a script that had too many pages and doing it by trying to, instead of removing scenes, removing words and cutting down, just it's almost impossible to make a serious dent in a word count by doing that, or a page count in that case. But it's crazy if you think about it. But he managed to do it and became famous doing it. So kudos.
And there really is. I mean, you know, obviously he'd written a few good books. I mean, he'd written several good books. He'd written a few very good books right before that. But I mean, I don't think that the Black Dahlia holds up the way that, or the Big Nowhere, the way that everything he did after that, you know, L.A. Confidential and White Jazz and American Tabloid in particular. I mean, like, so that style kind of made him, you know, I mean, he was great before, but it really made him in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, it's the old finding your voice, which, I mean, you know, he kind of did it already with success. But, whether you have no success or you're on the top of your game, you still have to find your voice. That's part of being a writer. And, you know, I don't think it's the person, the writer himself that gets to say when he's found his voice. You know what I mean? It has to be the world will click. The universe will let you know when you found it. You just gotta keep on pushing.
Do you reread your stuff?
Do I?
Yeah.
No. Do I mean,
re-read
do I reread it?
Yeah.
No. I mean, well, I'll reread a snippet now and again if I, you know, or if I have a have to read an excerpt, but I don't think so, not really. Maybe the short story in a while, I get a kick.
I do. I reread myself a lot, and I do it to like remind myself of The Voice. And, like, I don't reread everything. I just reread the things that I think were, like, the things I should be heading towards, like the places where I really got it right.
Yeah.
And it's just
well, my,
to train
my,
myself
my
to, like...
My overachieving brother will constantly go to my previous work and say, you know, your new, because he does read my stuff, and he's an eagle eye, and he's an attorney, so he, like, has a good eye for, you know, just there's a missing comma there, and this word is bad choice, you know, just that kind of stuff, copy editing. But he always seems to, you know, well, this one wasn't as visceral. It wasn't as, it doesn't have that same punch as, but, you know, it's taken a few books for me to realize he always says it about the previous one and not always about the first one. But I have gone back to kickstart myself, to pour a little, you know, a little starter fluid inside my engine to get things going. And that seems to work. But
Yeah, well,
maybe I should right now, because I'm due for another novel firing up any minute.
I hear you telling.
Yeah, I know. I've been, yeah, it's easy to get caught in between the side projects and stuff, and I don't have the main attraction on the table at the moment. But speaking of specifically Polly, you know, you shift pretty hard points of view in this, but it's always third person. You know, it would have been easy, I think, obvious to take a, you know, first person viewpoint of all these characters. You know, they shift chapter to chapter. What made you stick with third person?
I think it's so I could cheat a little bit on the, like, on the voice. Like, I think by doing Polly first person, I would have had to really lock down, like, an 11-year-old's tone and voice, and really have to ask myself, are these the metaphors that Polly would use? And sometimes I don't like it when you'd write first person and they still write like a good writer.
That's a really hard thing to do, because it becomes tricky, because if you stick with the voice of specifically a child or anybody that's like any sort of extreme character, you end up sort of becoming a caricature as opposed to a character. You know what I mean? So it's tricky.
Yeah, and I really do think that, you know, I have written short stories that were first person, and even one that was second person I didn't think was terrible, but, like, that very close third person, I think, is my favorite, and it lets you, you know, get into their heads, but still be able to describe things they might not describe, or, you know, and it also lets you kind of, by building that artificial wall, you can, you get to observe them a little bit more, I think. I like to, you know, not necessarily say what people are feeling using the words of emotions, but, like, trying to describe the states in a poetic way that I never think about myself. So I think that's why.
You know, most of Love and Other Wounds is in first person, though, right? Form or another.
50-50, I bet. I do think it's easier for a short story, though. I don't know why. This new book I'm working on, or threatening to work on, I was going to do the same way that I did She Ride Shotgun. It is, you know, it's very easy, I think, when you're doing six pages and you really need to get character across in six pages while doing everything else. First person really helps, because nothing introduces you to a person quicker than that. But I don't know. I feel like for a novel, I think that third person just, it's a little more freeing.
I think, and I know you've heard me pontificate about this before, but I am firmly in the third person court, because I think visually, when I talk about, you know, having the movie in your head and trying to make somebody else see that film, third person is the way to go. Because when you're in film, you're not inside somebody's head. You are that third person all the time as the camera. So I think it's to convey the shift of character and motion and pacing, I think it's just so much easier to stick in third person. But who was it? It was Les Edgerton who was having this argument with me over a couple whiskeys late at night, and he said, "No, the first person is the easy way to go. Third person is the harder route." And, you know, and that's what the accepted norm is, or why it's the accepted norm in mysteries. Got an opinion on that, sir?
Well, with mysteries, it kind of makes sense, because the thing about a mystery is that you're trying to withhold information, and, you know, you want to take people on along on that trip, that the detective is going on. So I could see where first person might be better if you're writing, the closer you're getting to like a straight ahead, like Agatha Christie novels are all first person, aren't they? Or am I making that up? I should
know
more
about
Agatha Christie. Yeah.
When I was like a serious, near hobo strung out on the streets, kind of scumbag. And I don't know whether it came from finding Agatha Christie books, but I went through a weird little period where I read, it must have been, 10 or 15 in a row, along with, F2 Barrow. But I didn't know that too. But it was a brief flirtation. So far in my 20s, I can't even remember back to it. But I don't think there. Maybe a listener would know.
Yeah. But no, I can't see the appeal. My instinct is that a first person, for me, a first person narration for a novel is difficult to pull off, particularly, and here's another part, is if you're switching viewpoints, because, I mean, this is an annoying question that I don't think readers ask, but like, there is always the question of like, in what way is this first person narrator telling this story? And so if you're switching viewpoints, does Nate, let's say if my book was written, if He Rides Shotgun was written in first person,
yeah,
who is Polly talking to? Who is Nate talking to? Do they know they're talking to each other? I don't know. Maybe other people don't even ask that question, but that I don't know. First person switching narrations is weird to me.
It does get confusing unless you're doing you're literally repeating the scene from somebody else's perspective, which is a little arty.
Yeah, I've never that whole Rashomon thing. I've never done that.
It makes me think of that book Edie about Edie Sedgwick, where they went through all the Warhol characters and got live tape from everybody. And that's what I always think of when I think of that. Maybe I should just switch characters and have different characters, different perspective. But I always fall back in the third person because I think the omnipresent. It's just the easy way to go. I like to think of that camera moving about the room. I like to be the camera and the director. That's what I like to think.
Well, and like you were talking about voice, and I do feel like I have a voice. And while I think, I do use different metaphors when I'm writing from Polly's point of view than I do when it's Scubby's point of view, and it bleeds through, but there is still that essential, thing, those choices I make about, I use a lot of hard consonant Anglo-Saxon words as opposed to, anything from, French with soft consonants. It's just, that's just something I do. And I want to keep doing that through the whole book. And so I have to have my voice in there too. So I think that's a lot of it.
There's Don DeLillo, his book Libra, which is where I sort of learned this really fast shifting point of view with still sticking in the third person. He has a tendency to do that where you won't even notice. Well, you do notice somewhere in your subconscious that it shifted from, it's about Oswald and his mother. It's about a lot of characters, but primarily those two, Lee Harvey Oswald and his mother. And when he switches to the mother's voice, he does the same thing where he, the words he chooses has whatever kind of old world accent she has, just a tinge where you don't really notice so much as feel it. And that, I was so impressed by that. I fell in love with the book. Although I don't know if his others sort of really have that tone for me, but that for me is the archetype of the third person, but yet a little bit first person at the same time, and that's kind of what the Rye Shotgun does, and that's a unique talent, I think.
I do think it's from Elroy. I think he was probably the person I paid the most attention to about doing that very, very close third person.
Speaking of, I'm not going to tie it too closely to your book, but I'm just curious, speaking of MK Ultra and things of that nature, are you a big conspiracy theory guy?
I don't believe in a lot of conspiracy theories, but I'm obsessed with them. And, I think in my youth I was, I was big into the JFK conspiracy, and then, I do feel like usually when you look at those things, they tend to the world. I think if Donald Trump, not to get all political and modern, if Donald Trump's proving anything, it's like, Machiavelli, that's just too much work. Like, nobody needs to do all that stuff. You just do the crime and then walk away. And But I am fascinated with them, and I love reading about them. I love reading internet posts for flat earthers and things like that. But why do you ask?
Well, let me ask you the question, the conspiracy theorist Beetle or Stone's question, which is JFK, was it the government or the mafia?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think you can make any sense out of the mafia doing it. Like, not to borrow too much from Oliver Stone, but like, since when has the mob ever used a sniper to kill anyone? Whereas I know that the CIA used snipers to kill Patrice Lumumba. Is that how you say his last name in Africa? I don't think there's anybody in the mob with that kind of skill set. So I don't find that one particularly credible.
Wow, that is.
I don't find the other one credible.
The government conspiracies I've never bought either, because the government's never had their stuff together well enough to silence the co-conspirators. they're not a very organized crew of people. So
have you read? I forget his name, but the guy who the famous prosecutor who put Charles Manson in jail and he wrote Helter Skelter. I should know his name.
Is it Bugliosi?
Yeah, Bugliosi. The audiobook of his book about JFK is very worthwhile. It's very long, but it's not as long as the actual book, which is enormous. But he wrote a massive book debunking the JFK conspiracy, and it's really worth listening to. But like, the basic argument of, like, you could not keep this a secret, it's ludicrous to say you could, is really kind of all you need to know. Like,
that is the unfortunate conclusion I come up with a lot of conspiracies.
Yeah.
You know, although it does kill the magic. Were you, as a young man out in the Midwest, were you tuning into Art Bell on your AM dial?
Did you
the Coast to Coast radio show?
No, I didn't know about Art Bell. Where was I getting my weird stuff from? My older brother was a real punk rock guy, and he was back into, like, back before the internet. Do you remember, like, tape trading?
I'm familiar with tape trading.
My brother was, like, a big tape trader, and he was, you know, he was on all these weird mailing lists, and he and I had subscribed to Anarchy Magazine, and, you know, I listened to a lot of punk rock. I definitely embrace a lot of the kind of conspiracy theories that, say, Jello Biafra would spouse long after I gave up a lot of the other ones. But and I still do believe a lot of them. I just believe most conspiracy theories are unintentional and unspoken and sometimes even unconscious, you know.
I do believe that, too, that they are sort of organically evolved just from people, like, believing that, sure, we're just doing the right thing and not really being so much a conspirator, you know what I mean?
Well, it's like, I think I understand corrupt cops a lot better than I used to. And part of that was going on ride-alongs with cops and seeing just bad cops, not Vic Mackey bad cops, just like bad cops who didn't like the people that they were policing. And, you know, they would take free meals from restaurants. That whole thing about on the sleeve, where you tap your sleeve and that means that this restaurant doesn't charge cops. And, like, you know, it's not like a little mafia, although it can obviously grow into something else. But I think it just starts with they're a little insular community, right? Like, cops hang out with cops. There's a real us or them mentality that breaks out, but breaks out most places. And then it's just laziness and sloth and minor corruption that just blossom and covering for each other and really us versus them. And I think that has to do more with it than any kind of, like, evil. I mean, although
yeah,
maybe that's what evil is. I don't know, but, like.
And it's certainly been, I would think, heightened in the past decade or so. So the us versus them, the police have to feel more isolated and more protective of each other than ever before. I mean, the worse things get, the more that factor increases, I would think. But
my experience with cops has led me to think that, like, obviously The Wire is very realistic, and one of the things that they got right that I always try and remember is I haven't met a lot of cops who seem like they hate criminals. They don't like criminals, but they don't hate them. Who they hate is prosecuting attorneys and their bosses. And when you see that, when I see that in a piece of work, that makes me think, oh, these people actually know cops. Like, they get it.
Yeah, bureaucracy, that's the enemy.
Yeah, exactly. Bureaucracy, chicken shit prosecutors who want too much evidence and are too worried about their conviction rate to really push cases. And, yeah, their bosses for being, for being hard asses or bureaucrats or not standing behind them, you know?
Yeah, well, I buy that. I buy that 110%. Well, listen, we've run technically over time. I thought I'd keep you about 20 minutes, but thanks to JFK, we're 10 minutes over.
Okay.
I got to say, Down and Out's name again. Down and Out is our current sponsor of the fabulous Skid Row Chatter, and
nice.
You know, they're also my publisher. So I give them the kudos for stepping forward and pushing the show. And the final obligatory question. What's next?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. Well, I'll tell you, I just took out a TV show. I have a very interesting piece of intellectual property that a movie studio came to me and asked me to take around and pitch as a TV show. I can't say it on the air, but I'll tell you about it off the air, and people will go, ooh, I wonder what that is. But it doesn't look like that's going to happen, so now it's time for me to move on to the next thing. I've written several drafts of the She Rides Shotgun screenplay, so hopefully that's almost to a shape that we can start trying to find a director and actors to be in that. I'm with a great, great producer, Parks McDonald. Walter Parks is the lead guy on that. He wrote Sneakers and War Games, so he's a very, very smart guy.
Killer.
And then I have a novel that I started writing, and it went astray, as novels sometimes do, and then I just, a couple weeks ago, had a long talk with Nat Sobel when I was in New York, and I think I've worked out the kinks, and now I'm doing, I don't really do research, I just read about things I like, but right now I'm reading a lot about skinhead gangs in Portland, and thinking maybe...
There's your teaser.
yeah, and I have a shape, and I have a character, and now I'm just at a place like, goddamn, novels are hard, and...
I said to Josh Stallings via message earlier, I was like, because he was bemoaning some issue he had, and I was saying that, you know, I tossed a novel at 20,000 words because it just, for whatever reason, doesn't really matter. But I said, you know, it's the hardest and the easiest thing you'll ever do. You know, when it clicks, when you're in the moment, it's great. But over the great span, it's a hard thing to do. It's like reeling in a whale.
Yeah. Yeah, or like it's like trying to put a whale together from different parts, and they're not all made out of whale, you know?
Yeah, there's some shark in there somewhere.
Yeah, and you don't know, and you just got to do your best to put a goddamn whale together. Oh, and you've never seen a picture of a whale. That would be the other.
Yeah, you've never seen a picture of the ocean even. Yeah, that seems about
exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, I thank you for coming on and spending a few minutes, and I wish you best, and I'm trying to end the show without bringing up that staticky music of mine from the 80s, which always crackles. So I will say, you know what? I've got to do one more piece of business. As I run back to my computer and hear my terrible echo, and I apologize to the listeners for our terrible beginning of the show. But, well, it's not written here. I'm supposed to do the official legal announcement about who it's copyrighted podcast owned by the Authors on the Air Global Network and so on and so forth, but this will have to do. You can find out more about downandoutbooks.com at downandoutbooks.com. You can find out about Jordan Harper just anywhere on the internet. Punch his name in, punch it into Twitter. He's very active. And is there anything you'd like to add for our faithful listeners?
Buy books. I just bought a book called American Static that I hear is quite good. Rumor is, so I'm looking forward to reading that. And buy She Rides Shotgun.
We'll be swapping reviews.
Fun. Fair enough.
She Rides Shotgun is amazing. It's fast flying, and it's a pleasure ride the whole way. And if you read it, review it. That is, since it's mostly writers that listen to the show, they probably all know how important those reviews are. So don't be shy. Let the world know what you think.
Indeed.
Right?
All right,
thank
dude.
You, Jordan. I'm going to have to cut you off. I won't be able to sneak any comments after because I'm not sure whether they're going to go out on the air. So I will
All right.
Speak to you soon. Thank you, sir.
All right. Talk to you later, Tom. Bye.
Good night.